Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Christine O'Donnell puts another tally mark in the Tea Party column in Delaware.
We are not in this to come close. We are in this to win. And win big we did.
A great night for the Tea Party, but
there's always a but.
No one expects the Republicans to win that Senate seat in Delaware, not even Karl Rove.
We were looking at 8 to 9 seats in the Senate. We're now looking at 7 to 8, in my opinion. This is not a race we're going to be able to win.
The Tea Party boasts big wins in races that will probably go to Democrats.
So what kind of wins are they, and what does it all mean for the Republicans in November?
It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, September 15th, and a lot of attention on the primaries, mainly because of the upsets.
Let's get a check of the morning's top news where the primaries sit right now. The Tea Party continues its coup d'etat against the GOP. In Delaware, Tea Party candidate Christine O'Donnell knocked off 9-term Republican Congressman Mike Castle in that Senate primary.
This isn't just about this U.S. Senate race. This is about changing the system.
In New York, Carl Paladino dealt another shock to the Republican establishment, defeating Rick Lazio in the race for that party's nomination for governor in New York.
New Yorkers are as mad as hell. And we're not going to take it anymore.
And in the fight for New Hampshire's Republican Senate nomination, another Tea Party insurgent is in a race that right now is still too close to call. This primary season, the Tea Party movement has claimed wins in at least 7 GOP Senate races, a handful of Republican gubernatorial contests, and dozens of House primary campaigns.
7 states and the nation's capital went to the polls yesterday. In Washington, D.C., Adrian Fenty is out as mayor. But in New York, Charlie Rangel, who has been charged with ethics violations, won big.
I want you to know, no matter what they say, I go back to Washington stronger than I've ever been.
The economy is probably going to be the big issue this November. That's no surprise. Senate Republicans are rolling out a plan to permanently extend the Bush-era tax cuts. That move would add $4 trillion to the federal deficit over the next decade. The health care overhaul will also be an issue. Yesterday, a federal judge said it's likely that portions of a 20-state lawsuit that challenges the new laws will go to trial. We're going to have a full primary roundup with Jeff Zeleny, the national political correspondent for a partner in the New York Times, in just a few minutes.
The Middle East peace talks moved to Jerusalem this morning, where Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Israeli and Palestinian leaders are pushing things forward.
I believe they are serious about reaching an agreement that results in 2 states living side by side in peace and security.
Before they get to 2 states, they'll have to deal with a moratorium on settlement construction that expires on the 26th of September, and the Palestinians have threatened to walk out if that expiration takes place. In Pakistan, officials say 2 U.S. drone strikes killed 14 militants in the tribal region near the Afghan border. The attacks make September one of the most intense periods of U.S. strikes in Pakistan since they all began back in 2004.
American Sarah Sherrod had this message for the Iranian president after her release from prison.
We want to address President Ahmadinejad and all of the Iranian officials and the religious leaders and thank them for this humanitarian gesture.
Now the State Department is challenging Ahmadinejad to do the same for the 2 men who were arrested with Sherrod last year. And New Orleans Saints running back Reggie Bush has returned the Heisman Trophy that he won at USC. He is the first winner to ever do so. Gold hit an all-time high yesterday. Asian markets are now mixed. European indices are down. Futures also down. The Dow's going to start at 10,526, the S&P at 1,121, and the NASDAQ at 2,289. So all morning, we're going to look at how the face of America changed at the start of the 20th century. Millions of African Americans moved out of the South to parts north and west. Our listeners have shared their own stories of the Great Migration, and we're going to hear from Isabel Wilkerson, author of the new great book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration.
But first, politics with Jeff Zeleny. Stay with us.
So we've got primary results in from 7 states, also the District of Columbia.
I love in Delaware and New York, the Tea Party winners have no chance of winning in November. Basically.
Really? None.
Yeah, that's the headline.
The thing is, you know what? If that were the headline, it would make more sense. But
perhaps.
No, that's not the headline. The headline is huge Tea Party wins in Delaware and New York. I mean, right?
Insurgency.
Right. You know. A coup of the Republican Party. So you've got Christine O'Donnell in Delaware. You've got Carl Palladino in New York, who defeated former Republican Rick Lazio. And this all leads to the political conversation as we move towards the midterms. Here to sort it out for us, Jeff Zeleny, national political correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
You probably stayed up to watch the returns, didn't you?
I did.
So tell me, what do you think the headline should be then?
Well, I think the headline from last night's primary contest is that the Tea Party scored a victory, but it will not likely be the same in November because it cost the Republicans most likely in both of the places that you mentioned. But you know, the most important race that will be looked at over and over again today is the race in Delaware. Was it a wise move for conservative party leaders, Republican leaders like Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, Sarah Palin of Alaska? Are they having a long-term strategy here in mind to support a candidate like Christine O'Donnell? It'll be talked about a lot.
Why do you say that? Why would you think that would be a bad move for conservative leaders to support someone like O'Donnell?
Well, they endorsed her candidacy. They helped her raise money. They helped her win a primary that was largely thought unwinnable, defeating a moderate member of the party. And she is almost certain to not win in November. And why is she certain to not win in November? Because a very small slice of the electorate had their say in the Delaware primary, for example. You know, some 57,000 voters have voted in the Republican primary. It was a closed primary, so independents could not vote. Democrats could not vote, of course. But in the general election, she is just not, will almost certainly not be able to build this type of coalition that a Republican like Mike Castle, a moderate, would have been able to. So a short-term strategy for some of these conservative party leaders, conservative leaders of the Republican Party, because you know, every state is not the same. So electing a candidate like this in Delaware is almost certain to bring defeat in November.
So Jeff, it sounds like what you're sketching out here is that because of such low turnout in these primary races, a statistical anomaly can look like a national movement and a political insurgency, but even though in media terms the Tea Party might be set up for 2012, you say it's just statistical game playing?
In some parts of the country, some of the things that have happened during these primary campaigns have been very real. Some candidates have won their primaries, and they will almost certainly go on to win the general election. So I think we have to be pretty careful in looking at the midterms as not a national phenomenon, but a state-by-state collection of races. And in some of these places where the insurgent candidate has won, have won their primary, you know, they most likely will be able to at least strongly challenge a Democrat or win in November. But in places like Delaware that are, you know, reliably Democratic, it's just, you know, the number of votes just are not there for a candidate like this to win a general election.
Well, you know, let's go back to your saying that you question, some people are questioning the wisdom of somebody like a conservative like Sarah Palin in supporting a Christine O'Donnell. But if for the conservatives who want to change the Republican Party, who feel that it has gone too far to the left and want to bring it back towards the right, maybe this is the strategy.
You know, it is the strategy, but I mean, you heard a Republican strategist after Republican strategist last night and early this morning, you know, saying the same thing. Even Karl Rove said, you know, these candidates are not electable. So it's a fine strategy, you know, but the security test that has gone on in the Republican Party just does not work in all states around the country. And Delaware, again, is a reliably Democratic vote or moderate, you know, at the outside, and there just are not enough Republicans who share this view of these candidates to win a general election.
Can you sketch out what was at stake in New Hampshire? That's too close to call right now, but give us a sense. I mean, the Tea Party candidate is still in it because it is too close to call, but what was going on in New Hampshire if this is a state-by-state kind of thing?
New Hampshire is a little bit of a different situation. Again, in midterms, every race does not fit sort of into the same rubric, but the New Hampshire Senate race is too close to call. But seven Republican candidates were on the ballot. Right now, the top two candidates are Ovid LaMontagne, who was the more conservative candidate, and he was supported by some Tea Party groups, but he's run for office before. He's viewed as more of a mainstream Republican candidate. He's not a sort of fitting the same brand as some of the insurgents we've seen across the country. Anyway, he is holding a very narrow, he's trailing just by a few hundred votes to the former attorney general of the state, Kelly Ayotte, who is clinging to, you know, some 900-point lead with 85% of the precincts in. But New Hampshire is not quite the same situation. Republicans believe that that either candidate has a shot of winning the general election in November.
Well, then let's get to the big issue. How does this set up Sarah Palin going forward? And what is the likelihood now, based on these results, of, say, the Democrats losing the House or the Republicans taking the Senate, the really the big contest?
Well, Republicans are still poised to make major gains in the House, so this has not changed that. Democrats know that there are enough seats in play for Republicans to win the majority. In the Senate, though, it diminishes the possibility of Republicans winning control of the Senate. Now they have to look for a seat someplace else. They had thought they could win in Delaware with a moderate on the ticket. Now they will have to find their victory somewhere else. So those 10 seats, that 10-seat majority that Democrats hold in the Senate, will be hard for Republicans to narrow down.
Yes or no, Jeff Zeleny, Sarah Palin can do no wrong?
We'll find out.
Jeff Zeleny, the brilliant Jeff Zeleny, national political correspondent for our partner, the New York Times.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Later this hour, we're going to be talking to the author of a new book about the Great Migration. That was a period of time when 6 million African Americans left the South.
It was a real movement.
People don't realize how huge a change it was. Number one, because it took 6 decades for it to occur. And two, you're talking about something that occurred quietly.
Changed the electoral map, changed sociological
culture,
changed cities.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe how many people are a product of the Great Migration. And we started this conversation online. We are asking you for your family stories of the Great Migration to try and help us put this into perspective. And one of you responded. Della Beaver joins us now. She's a Takeaway listener who listens online through thetakeaway.org and wrote on our website with her family's migration story. Good morning, Della.
Good morning.
You are in Chester, Pennsylvania.
That is correct.
Is that the place that your family landed when they left the South?
It is.
So your family moved from what state?
From South Carolina, Fairfield County, right outside of Columbia, South Carolina.
And when? What year was this?
1939.
Okay, so tell me about what part of your family moved and why they made that decision.
Okay, well, both my parents came. My father came with his mother, two brothers, and his two sisters. And my mother, who was one of nine, came by herself with my father. So all her family still resides in the South and the extended family, but those are the ones who came up here to Chester, Pennsylvania.
Okay, and they met in Pennsylvania?
No, they actually met in South Carolina. They were all raised lived around the same place in South Carolina.
You know, many people don't tell stories among their families about the Great Migration and what prompted them to move because it was a relatively painful thing. Did you guys share stories?
Not really. Not until later on in my life when I became interested in my family history and before my parents were deceased. And I asked my father why he came to Pennsylvania. And there were two reasons. The first was that for him and for his family, they saw the opportunity in the North that they did not have in the South. And the other thing is that my father was someone who would not allow people to treat him less than a man. And he found that in the South, he could not do the yes man, no man thing. So they decided to come on up North.
Did he tell you stories of some of the other things that happened to him growing up? Did they talk about what South Carolina was like?
Not a lot. Not in our family. There wasn't a lot of talk about what happened to them in the South. It was only through me doing our family history that I learned some of these things. But they were very closed-mouthed about the things that happened in the South. I tell a story that we went back to the South every single year when I was growing up. That was our family tradition. And it was before I-95 was built. So we used to leave about 3, 4 o'clock in the morning and drive down Route 13. And my mother would always pack this big cooler full of food. And for our bathroom stops, they were the side of the roads. And I could never understand why we couldn't go into the restaurants to use the bathroom or eat. And later on in life, my father told me that he would not subject his children to feeling less than because of the color of their skin. And so that's why we did what we did.
That's an amazing story, Della Beaver. You know, one of the things that Isabel Wilkerson gets to in her book, and we're going to talk with her a little later in the hour, are these visions of people who moved from the South and seeing Chicago for the first time or seeing Detroit for the first time and just what a magical place the North was until they got down to business and discovered just how tough life could be. Did you remember in your family stories of what this place they were going to turned out to be like?
To them, it just was the land of opportunity because they came up here. My father found a very good job. And, you know, it's amazing that he raised 12 children on a salary of not more than $25,000 a year.
Wow.
But to him, this was the land of opportunity, and he was able to make a good life for himself, his wife, and his children.
Well, your mother was one of 9 children, right?
That's correct.
And your father was one of 11?
That's correct.
How many of the rest of your family members also moved either north or west?
Only when my father came, there were only 5 of them plus his mother who came. And as I said, my mother's family did not come at all. She was the only one.
So they're still in South Carolina?
Yes, they are still in South Carolina. I go down and visit them. All her sisters and brothers are deceased, as is my father's sisters and brothers. But the rest of my extended family is in the South.
Della, you know, I hear how you're describing this, and Celeste and I have talked about just how important this migration has been sociologically to America. How proud are you of what they did?
I am extremely proud, and it took a lot of courage, especially for my mother to get up and leave all that she knew and all of her family to come here and make a new life. But I tell people all the time, I am proud of my family all the way back through history, because if not for the strength of my grandparents who went through slavery, and I tell people I'm proud because I am the second generation in my family who was born into freedom. My grandfather was a slave. He was born in 1859 before the end of slavery. And if not for their strength, I would not be who I am today, and I would not be where I am today.
You know, Della, one last thing. Isabel Wilkerson points out in her novel that the Great Migration was the first independent act of a people who are actually in bondage for longer, still today, longer than they've been free. And I'm wondering, looking back for you, do you feel like progress has occurred fast enough?
Yeah, I do believe it has, because we are people who came from nothing, and look at where we are today. And there's a lot more to go. I mean, of course, America is always going to be, you know, a struggle, but we need to be proud of where we are.
Della Beaver, Takeaway listener, listens online through thetakeaway.org and wrote on our website where their family's migration story, leaving South Carolina for Pennsylvania. Thank you so much, Della.
Thank you. It was an honor.
And
we met Della online. You met her on the radio.
That's
using our radio show as a
and
place to share a great story.
And we want to hear your story as well. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us your stories of the Great Migration. Something significant and terrible and tragic is going on in Mexico right now. And in order to understand it, it's important to tell stories from all different angles. Today, we're going to look at the story of one particular television cameraman who has fled Mexico and is seeking asylum here in the United States. Alejandro Hernandez Pacheco is one of four Mexican journalists who were kidnapped earlier this summer by gang members who then demanded national television coverage. And Pacheco says his country can no longer protect him or journalists like him from the danger that comes with reporting on crimes related to drug cartels in Mexico. We're joined in the studio right now by Monica Campbell. She's a freelance reporter and 2010 Nieman Fellow. Monica served as the Committee to Protect Journalists Mexico representative for several years and was recently there researching. And Monica, I got to ask you, Pacheco's claim that the government can no longer protect journalists, first of all, is that true?
Well, what you have in Mexico is an unprecedented wave of violence, and that violence is affecting journalists like we've never seen before. So what we have is the government's inability to protect your average Mexican, and that does not mean that your average journalist is immune from that danger as well.
But other journalists have sought asylum in the United States and, as I understand, have not been approved.
Right. Well, the asylum policy, that issue is quite tricky, and that's something that journalists in Mexico are testing right now when it comes to U.S. policy. What happens is that journalists in Mexico have no recourse. So if you're threatened in Mexico and you're doing your basic job as a journalist and you're receiving threats from drug traffickers, from the authorities who are protecting them, you have nowhere to go. There's no guarantee. We're talking about a country right now where journalists, much less your average Mexican, they don't feel safe going to the authorities if a crime is committed against them. You're not seeing crimes solved. So you don't have a justice system that you can go to if you're a journalist in danger.
More than 30 journalists have been killed or disappeared in Mexico since President Felipe Calderon was elected in 2006. And this is kind of the maelstrom that Alejandro Hernandez Pacheco got dumped into in his job as a TV cameraman. And we have with us his attorney from El Paso, Texas, Carlos Spector, who we've spoken to before. Welcome back to the program, Carlos.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So first, tell us, what did the kidnappers want from Mr. Pacheco when he was kidnapped?
Well, what this represents is a real escalation in the repression and use of the media by the cartels. What they wanted, and it's the first time it's been done at this level, was to force a national television program to show a video of the Chapo Guzman cartel criticizing the Zetas, of which they're involved in a bloody battle in that region. Now, Alejandro was covering a situation in Gomez Palacios, which is across the river from Torreón, Coahuila, and they were covering a situation where the director of the state prison was allowing and directing nighttime hits with her prisoners in the community. They got wind of this, they covered it, and they exposed it. So in retaliation for that coverage, the cartel, the Guzman cartel, had videos of federal police being interrogated saying that they were involved with the Zetas. So it was a PR battle between cartels, and the cameramen were pawns in as much as they got kidnapped to force Televisa nationally. And this is, I think, part of the news, because most of the coercion and the corruption and the violence has been with local media. So this marks an escalation in that. Now, The other problem with this case, which is symptomatic of what's happening with journalism, is that 90% of the cases against journalists are unsolved. In this particular case, the kidnappers, after 5 days of torturing, starving, beating, and threatening with death, ultimately released them on Saturday, 5:30 in the morning of July 31st. They found the police as they were running through the street. Admittedly, the police were in the area looking for them. Now, after being, and Alejandro was bleeding from the head, you know, the police pick him up around 6. They have no medical attention. They give him a muffin. They don't give him a shower. No psychological treatment.
I assume all of this is part of his case to seek asylum in the United States. Monica, let me ask you, you actually contributed to a report on the dangers facing journalists in Mexico for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And that's really the question we're left with, is how does one keep journalists safe in Mexico? Because I would assume that good reporting on this issue is pretty important.
It's up to the journalists to keep themselves safe. So without any guarantees of safety, without any guarantee of a reliable justice system, it's up to you as the journalist to watch your own back.
And it's pretty chilling.
It's absolutely chilling. Last time I was in Mexico, I was in Juarez this summer, in Ciudad Juarez, right across the river from El Paso, Texas, one of the safest cities in America. And you go to Ciudad Juarez, and there's at least 10 killings a day. And for the first time in my reporting years in Mexico, I was unable to go to certain parts of the state of Chihuahua, where Juarez is located, with other journalists, because you have to go together. And they wouldn't take me because those areas were just simply too dangerous to report from.
That is Monica Campbell, freelance reporter and 2010 Nieman Fellow, served as the Committee to Protect Journalists Mexico representative for several years. We also spoke with Carlos Spector. He's an immigration attorney from El Paso, Texas, who is representing Alejandro Hernandez Pacheco.
You know, this year I really put extra effort in, you know, just competing and come back this year. And like you saw, you know, me just working out with LT, just little stuff like that, you know, gave me the courage to do the things that I needed to get back here and compete and win this thing.
Win this thing. That's a very happy Reggie Bush back in 2005, having just won the Heisman Trophy. Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdelmateen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Did you ever dream of winning the Heisman when you were a football player?
That's funny. I think I was convinced that I was going to win the Heisman at one point. Just like any running back in the United States, there's a certain point where you're like, I'm going to do it. It's going to happen. And I was going to do it playing for Syracuse.
So a common dream for a football player, but can you imagine the feelings going through Reggie Bush right now, having to give it back? The historic moment came yesterday. He had to take it back, send it back to the Heisman Committee for violations at USC.
Well, now he's in the NFL. He plays for the New Orleans Saints, where he won a Super Bowl last year. So that's sweet. And he's a former Heisman Trophy winner, which is difficult to take in a sense. But the reality is that his alma mater, USC, has been enshrouded in controversy since his college playing days. USC was recently smacked with heavy sanctions by the NCAA for improper benefits that were received by Bush.
And the sanctions, and the kind of benefits we're talking about are what?
Let's say you get access to you can get a car, your parents get a house or a
dwelling.
That
was in Reggie Bush's case. Precisely. His parents were living in a house paid for by
exactly.
The university.
Those are typical things that happen when an outside external person or source gives money to a player that's on a scholarship, and NCAA has very strict rules against you receiving money when you're on a scholarship.
And this money actually didn't come from USC. It came from a sports marketer who was sort of a liaison between USC, which is why the school's in trouble.
Exactly. So there's very strict rules about the college athletes being amateurs. And so when these external forces sort of try and come in, like marketer or potential agent, they're trying to woo these young athletes because they see the potential payoff for them down the road. And so that's really what they're trying to protect the athletes from being overly influenced by external forces.
So as a As a football player yourself, maybe you have sympathy for Reggie Bush, because is he more of a victim of USC's culture here? Or as a journalist, do you say, hey, you blew it?
I say that's interesting. I think the victims are actually the players that play for USC now, because now the sanctions that are on USC include a 2-year bowl ban, so they can't play in postseason play, and then also 4 years probation, and they lose scholarships. So
it's tens of thousands of dollars of scholarships.
Precisely. So I think that Reggie Bush, really, instead of giving the Heisman back, he would be better served by appealing to the NCAA to sort of lessen those sanctions. And maybe this is a part of that process. Maybe he's sending an olive branch to the NCAA and to the folks to say, hey, listen, could you make it easier on these guys that are actually playing that had nothing to do with what I did?
So Bush's gesture may end up helping those USC students if the sanctions come off early, although there's no indication that that might happen.
It could potentially help. And I think the other piece of this is here. Reggie Bush essentially cheated. By being ineligible, he cheated.
Right.
It's different than cheating and using steroids, because it doesn't affect your play on the field. So it doesn't diminish what he did on the field that year. He was the best player on the field.
Right.
And that year, you know, Vince Young got second in the Heisman voting, but he won the national championship.
And it's part of the sadness. The Heisman committee will just vacate the award. There will be no award, and that's how it will go in the record books.
Correct.
Does Reggie Bush just go back to playing NFL football? This is the end of it?
And he's probably going to win another Super Bowl. So I think it's all good for Reggie Bush.
Thank you, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor.
Good morning.
It was a leaderless revolution. 50 years after the end of the Civil War, blacks in the South found they couldn't vote and they couldn't protect their families. They couldn't pass a white driver on the road. They couldn't offer to shake a white man's hand. They couldn't contradict a white person, or even in some places, they couldn't stay out past 8 p.m. Jim Crow made their citizenship less than meaningless. It made it an irony. And so they left. Quietly and without fanfare, and without really knowing the kind of massive change that they were making in the country's economic and cultural landscape. 6 million African Americans left the South. It's called the Great Migration, and it's the subject of Isabel Wilkerson's new book. She calls it the first mass act of independence by a people who were in bondage in this country for far longer than they have been free, the first big step the nation's servant class ever took without asking. The book's called The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of the Great Migration, and Isabel Wilkerson joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
You spent 15 years of research on this book, and as I understand, it was really because you discovered that nobody had written this book before, and you decided to write it yourself.
That's correct. I grew up as the child of the migration in Washington, D.C. My mother had migrated from Georgia to Washington, D.C., and my father from Southern Virginia to Washington, D.C. in different decades, and met there at Howard University and married. And I am a product and perhaps would not even exist without the Great Migration, which is the case for many African Americans in the North and West.
And knowing that, it's really no surprise that you chose to center this book around three personal individual stories of three people. And you chose them after you interviewed about 1,200 people. You went all over the country looking for people who were part of the Great Migration, and you settled on three.
Yes, I settled on three. One was a sharecropper's wife in Mississippi. Her name was Ida Mae Gladney, and she left because there was a cousin of theirs who was beaten within an inch of his life over a theft that he had not committed.
And another one that's just really interesting is the story of Robert Foster, and he was an incredibly talented, smart doctor, and maybe you could tell us about his migration.
Yes, he migrated from Monroe, Louisiana, because he'd served in the Army as a surgeon, but when he got back home, he found that he could not practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe in Louisiana, and he decided to set off on what became an unexpectedly treacherous journey across the desert alone. He was going to get to California and send her his family, but he had a traumatic experience in trying to get across the country, partly because there was no place that he could stay. There was no place that would accept him and allow him to stay. And I attempted in the course of the research of this book to recreate that journey myself. And I could only make it as far as Yuma, Arizona.
Well, you know, one of the things that you're examining in this book is how the Great Migration changed America. And it's impossible to really trace all of the different threads, although you do a really, really great job. But one of the things that struck me was just culturally, you list off a number of the musicians who would never have been born had their parents not met after migrating from the South. I mean, it's really like the course of music history, not just jazz, but we wouldn't have Motown were it not for the Great Migration. We wouldn't have Miles Davis. I mean, it really changed what we think of as American culture.
It's incomprehensible, really, to imagine what would culture look like in our country and sound like in our country had it not been for the Great Migration. First of all, the majority of African Americans that you meet in the North and West are descended from the Great Migration. 90% of all African Americans were living in the South at the time of the migration began in the early part of the 20th century. By the end of the migration, half of them were living outside of the South in the North, and they were living in the North and the West and the Midwest. And so, of course, Motown is phenomenal because it would simply not have existed without this migration. Berry Gordy, whose parents migrated from Georgia to Detroit, had they not done that, their son would not have been in Detroit to be able to draw from other children of the Great Migration, such as Diana Ross, the Jackson family, so many of the people in Motown. When it comes to jazz, it's incomprehensible what might have happened. Miles Davis, his parents migrated from Arkansas to Illinois, where he got the opportunity to play. It's just incomprehensible, the thought of his not having the opportunity to learn to play. Thelonious Monk, his parents migrated from North Carolina to Manhattan, to Harlem, when he was 5 years old. And John Coltrane migrated at 17 from North Carolina to Philadelphia, where he got his first alto sax.
That is a pantheon.
It is.
Definitely. You know, Isabel, one of the things that's also incomprehensible is you can't really think visually about the northern industrial cities in the United States without large African-American populations. Yet this vivid scene on page 226 of your book, when Ida May got her first glimpse of Chicago, what did it look like at the time, Chicago, you asked her? It looked like heaven to me then, she said. And that's a different Chicago than we know today, right?
It is, because you imagine these people having come from rural open land with just fields and fields of either cotton for those people from those states, fields and fields of tobacco from people in those states, and arriving in these big cities with all of this energy, this metabolism, the streetcars, the high rises, the people clip-clopping on the sidewalk. I mean, it was overwhelming for them, and it was exactly what they had hoped for.
You know, Isabel, their motivation in writing the book, I assume, wasn't just for the purposes of history, but there's something that you talk about, which is an odd phenomenon, to me at least, which is that so few people who were part of the Great Migration ended up really sharing the stories of what they endured in the South with their kids. We talked to one of our listeners whose father brought their family out of South Carolina. This is a story she told about going back to the South every year.
We went back to the South every single year when I was growing up and drive down Route 13. And my mother would always pack this big cooler full of food. For our bathroom stops, they were the side of the roads. And I could never understand why we couldn't go into the restaurants to use the bathroom or eat. And later on in life, my father told me that he would not subject his children to feeling less than because of the color of their skin.
But Isabel, Della didn't find out that from her father until she had to ask and press her dad for details about the Great Migration. Why are people so reluctant to really talk about it?
Well, I had that exact same experience with my own mother. She didn't want to talk about it. And part of it was because when they left for good. They were in some ways not relocating from one place to another, but they were in some ways seeking asylum. And they turned their back on all of that and started anew. Like any immigrant who may have come across from the Atlantic in steerage, they really were starting a new life, and they wanted to start fresh and not think about what they had gone through. They did not share it with their children in the same way that immigrants often do not want their children to necessarily know the old language, because they want to start new and be American. And that's what these people were trying to do. I discovered things about my own family that I had no idea. For example, how my uncle had left the South was because he had discovered that the man he was working for when he was cleaning up for him in his office. That was one of his jobs. He opened a drawer and he found some white fabric. He pulled it out and unfurled a white robe and hood. And at that moment, he decided he was going to leave. And he went to Detroit.
Isabel Wilkerson.
I hadn't heard that.
And I imagine you are probably speechless, as I am. Isabel
Wilkerson. How proud are you of that, of those experiences?
I believe that the Great Migration should be a part of American history that we all know about, and it was my goal to restore it to its rightful place in history through the lives of the people that I've interviewed.
And that's what she's done. Isabel Wilkerson is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration, an incredible book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can read the first chapter of The Warmth of Other Suns on our website, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, keep the conversation going. If your family was a part of the Great Migration, when did they leave the South? Where did they go? Share the story at thetakeaway.org. You don't have to be Miles Davis, but you're one of them.
Yeah, my family
you were
a
part
did.
Of that story.
Yeah, left Arkansas.
Well, you should go to thetakeaway.org and share your
Maybe
story.
Maybe I will. Maybe I'll blog about it.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.